Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and members of the university. My name's Alex Chernoff, for those who don't know me, and I'm the Chancellor of the university, and in that capacity, may I welcome you tonight, the start of our first Festival of Ideas. I begin in our customary way by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners of the land on which this event is taking place. And in keeping with demands of modern technology, I've been told to ask you to switch off your mobile telephones, not because their presence switched on will interrupt what I'm about to say, but because importantly tonight's lecture will be audio recorded and filmed. An article published in the Times Higher Education only a couple of weeks ago, which I recently read, asked, where are the scholars providing intellectual exploration of the challenges facing society today? The thesis being that the main goal of academics seems to be not advancing freedom of inquiry, but the myopic pursuit of self-advancement. It is true that in this analysis, the author said that the UK higher education system, unlike anywhere else in Europe, the status of scholars is low. Now, if that be the case, may I suggest that holding this festival and all that this entails amply demonstrates once again the University of Melbourne being at the forefront of providing intellectual exploration of challenges facing today's society. May I provide a few particulars? The theme of our week-long festival is climate change, cultural change, and will examine many of the most important issues and problems facing our society in the near future. You will hear about the effects climate change will bring to our environment, our lifestyle, our cities and suburbs, and what changes we must make to meet these challenges, which are the greatest challenges of the new millennium. Australia's most immediate future will be shaped as well by other forces external to our shores. What is the future of the West? How will it emerge from its present economic crisis? And what effect will an altered Western world have on Australia? These weighty questions will be asked in the coming week, and the answers may well surprise us all. But nobody can discuss Australia's future without referring to China as an economic superpower with deep stakes in our economy. And it is unsurprising that this topic has been the subject of commentary and, if I may say so, speculation, in my view, in the media, particularly of late. Dare we ask it, but is Beijing-Canberra now our true special relationship? Now, the festival has assembled a group of leading sinologists to grapple with that question, led by the distinguished international scholar, Professor Wong Gungwu, whom we welcome back to the university with particular appreciation. Now, amidst all this storm and stress of these issues, how important it is we hear the voice of artists and humanists. The festival comes to an exciting climax with an extended consideration of the place of the writer in the time of change. At the university, we take particular pride that our own faculty and students are playing a leading role in the panels and discussion groups. But we are no less honoured that so many leading figures from abroad and interstate have agreed to participate. Surely any festival that starts with our Nobel laureate Peter Doherty and ends with such a distinguished Australian writer as Kate Grenville must offer a rich and diverse array of ideas. And on behalf of the university, I would like to thank the Age newspaper, which has given the event wonderful editorial support. We're grateful yet again to the Meganya Fund for underwriting a substantial part of this festival, and to Trinity College, which has generally played host to some of our most distinguished guests and speakers, and it has done so in the most generous way. I thank you coming here tonight to help launch this event, and I hope you may have one of the most stimulating weeks in your life. May I now ask the Vice-Chancellor, Professor Glyn Davis, to chair the first session.
Chancellor, thank you. May I echo your warm welcome to everyone to tonight. It's delightful that you're here. Can I acknowledge the director of this festival, Professor Patrick McCackie, who's done a wonderful job of putting this together. Can I thank our enthusiastic protesters outside for setting the right tone for our university? It is important that protesting voices are heard, but it's also important to know that the university is speaking to staff through their representatives. And can I welcome you to this momentous opening, made all the more enjoyable by your presence here, by the people we know will be on the campus through the next week. Can I particularly acknowledge the many alumni who returned to university for this Festival of Ideas, but to everyone who's here, we hope you find it a marvellous time. Let me commend to you, if I may, the book that you hopefully found on your seat. This is a wonderful book edited by Helen Sykes, who's with us tonight. Welcome, Helen. It's an anthology of recent writing on our prime topic, climate change for young and old. A copy is provided to everyone who participates in this festival. Three of our key speakers have contributed to the book, so it's a very stimulating read and I hope part of your enjoyment of this week. But we'd like to start in a very special way. Lee Arbenier is a singer and a songwriter born in Tuvalu, a graduate of the Willen Centre for Indigenous Artists at the Faculty of the Victorian College of the Arts and Music. I'm sure all of us are aware of the threat that climate change poses to the nine islands of Tuvalu, right there as rising oceans bring the consequences home so quickly. Tonight, Leah will sing a song, Hawiki, which is the name given by Polynesians to their spiritual homeland. Leah's ancestors navigated the vast reaches of the Pacific Ocean by the stars, seeking new islands, and her song is one of hope and longing that it will connect her and present-day Tuvaluans to the strength and resourcefulness of their ancestors as they face a very uncertain future. Could you please welcome Leah Arvana?
Thank you. Talofa, my name is Leah Arvana. I was born in Tuvalu, which is a low-lying nation in the Pacific, made up of nine atolls. The rising tide is currently claiming what little land we have, and our people, like many people in low-lying nations, face an uncertain future. If we lose our homeland, we also risk losing our culture, our language, and the spirit of our people. The song I'm performing tonight is called Hawaiki. There are variations of the name Hawaiki across Polynesia. Savai'i, Hawaii, Hawaiki. It is acknowledged across Polynesia as the land that we originated from. The exact location is a mystery, so Hawaiki lives on in the stories we tell as our spiritual homeland. Navigating by the stars, our ancestors braved the vast expanses of the Pacific Ocean to find new lands. As a result of climate change, we now may once again have to voyage to new lands. I seek comfort in knowing that we all have a spiritual homeland that connects us to our ancestors and to each other. Our people have a long history of strength, resilience, and powerful spirituality, and I believe this will serve us well in these uncertain times. I hold great hope that we will adapt to change and hold on to our beautiful culture. Skin, I'm sitting here dreaming. I let my mind take me there. And I know who you are. I recognize I don't want her anywhere. And when I no longer have this land to plant my feet on, I'll look to the stars, say goodbye, aloha, let them guide me back home. Of earth hums with my own heart songs, and I hear them calling out across the reef. And how can I cease to care? Left part of my soul there. And I hear it in the rhythm of that distant beat. And when I no longer have this land to plant my feet on, I look to the stars, say goodbye, aloha, let them guide me back home. Have this sand to rest my head on. I look to the skies, wipe the tears from my eyes. Let the stars guide me. Home. I look to the stars, say goodbye, aloha. Let them guide me back home. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. It's hard to imagine a more apposite start to a discussion about climate changes and its consequences. Thank you again. A beautiful performance. And now it's a great pleasure to introduce our acclaimed Laureate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, Peter Doherty. A headline about Peter in Cosmos magazine once said that winning a Nobel Prize is about as easy as wrestling a pig, a reference to his days as a veterinary scientist. In fact, it's probably harder and more tough. As Peter himself has proved through an extraordinary, hard-working career spanning pathology, microbiology, and immunology across several continents. He's made an important contribution to human knowledge by his determination to follow the evidence from research, even when that evidence proves unsettling and unnerving. Peter shared the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1996 with his Swiss colleague, Rolf Zinkernagel, for the discovery of how the immune system recognises virus-infected cells. He was named Australian of the Year in 1997. We're delighted at Melbourne to have Peter as a very active presence on our campus, both for himself and for the continuous contribution he makes to public debate. Many of us know Peter Doherty through his witty and insightful books, The Beginner's Guide to Winning the Nobel Prize, and the wonderful A Light History of Hot Air. These are ways he uses to talk to a wider public about core issues in science. Recently he warned, and I quote, that we need to face up to the reality of climate change and renewable sources of energy. And until we do that, we won't get anywhere and we won't find the wisdom to meet the challenges at hand. There's no more appropriate person to open our Festival of Ideas on climate change, cultural change. Please join me in welcoming Professor Peter Doherty.
Thank you. Thanks, Glyn, and thank you, Laya, for reminding us of the human dimension of this whole issue, because it is a massive issue. As the Vice-Chancellor said, my real field of expertise is microbiology, immunology, and pathology. I'm an experimentalist, so that if you combine those fields together, you get experimental mythology, which is what I do for a living. And I guess I've been asked to open this because I know a lot less about it than most of the people who are going to be speaking. That may be a qualification. But of course, if you're a Nobel Prize winner, you can speak with authority on absolutely everything, which is one of the dangers, especially as Alzheimer's gets us as we join the ranks of the elderly. I'm actually still an active scientist. And I work with two very bright groups of young people at the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And the Vice-Chancellor talked about wrestling a pig. That's the sort of thing they do in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a very muddy place. They're very much into hogs. And we work there on the early stages of influenza virus infection, and we're into some kind of big science of systems biology, which is a lot of mathematics and computing. We're collaborating with a multi-center effort, trying to understand what goes on in the influenza virus-infected lung. Now, I mention this because over the last 10 years or so, the realities of science in my area, in experimental biology, have changed out of all sight. And they've changed out of all sight because of advances in technology, advances in readout systems, advances in computing, and massive capacity for number crunching. And this has gone across the whole of science. It's not just biology, it's what determines what's happening in this whole area of climate science, which is even more dependent on those sorts of advances. And so a lot of historical knowledge, I think, in fields is useful, but it's only useful really if you're interacting with the people who are doing the contemporary stuff. And at the moment, I'm still involved to some extent, so I'm not totally historic or toast, as the Americans would say. The other group is at the University of Melbourne, and we're working on what I'd been doing for years, the killer T cell. I'll show you a little bit of that, though it has nothing whatsoever to do with climate change, but I've got to fill this up somehow or other. And I thought I was giving a 40-minute talk, and it's actually I've been given 55 minutes, and actually Nobel Prize winners can speak for hours and hours, especially if they have Irish background. This is the facility at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is a wonderful and very wealthy institution. This facility here, I don't see if you can see the rubbish tins outside, is the Department of Microbiology at the University of Melbourne, which there's only been one other building like this on campus, and they recently knocked it down. And it's currently filling up with the new neuroscience building, which is a wonderful building. And this is the proposed, one of the proposals for the new microbiology building, which will be the former Ampol headquarters and now motel on the corner of Grattan Street and Royal Parade, which we got some money out of the feds for that.
In your honour?
Yeah, kind of. Well, we'll see. Anyway, so being involved in science is kind of great, and it's a great privilege, of course, to be able to talk with a lot of bright young people. And though people say the young are turning away from science, we certainly have some wonderful young people working in science, in microbiology at least, at Melbourne University. Right. We get this thing to change. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to go into this. That's influenza virus, and we all know about influenza. All Victorians now are authorities on influenza. I don't need to tell you about it. They're ducks. Influenza. Well, I did train as a vet. Influenza is actually a disease of aquatic birds, which gets across into us and causes problems, as you know. And this is just to show you influenza spreading. This is a seasonal influenza spreading across the United States. The swine flu is not spreading as rapidly as the seasonal influenzas, but you can see that this is typical influenza. It starts in Texas, as a lot of really bad things do. And it goes right across the United States in about 6 weeks. And, of course, influenza is a scary disease, and it's being a respiratory infection, it's not one of those infections you can decide to change your behaviour and not get it. And, of course, it is spread very quickly around the world by international air travel. And so if with climate change we no longer have jet planes, trying to deal with it, we no longer have jet planes, maybe we'll pick up on the flu a bit and be a bit protected. Now, influenza is not one of the diseases that's going to be greatly impacted by climate change. Some diseases are. We think mosquito-borne diseases, for instance, we will get them moving further away from the tropics more into the northern and southern latitudes. And also, we're already seeing some evidence of diseases like malaria in Africa, which are normally in the low-lying areas, starting to move up the hills into the cooler areas, which is a matter of considerable distress. Because malaria, for instance, kills about 500,000 kids a year. It's still a very bad disease. And it's one of those diseases we only just control. You know, there's a lot of things in particularly infectious disease and so forth that we're just in control of. Change the balance too much and we could have serious issues. This is what I work on. These are killer T cells bouncing around on some tumour cells. I don't think you'll see it very well with the light on, but this is one of them actually doing some killing. That's going to kill that. See? That's killed. That is. I can tell you as a veterinary pathologist, that is dead. I mean, it's a silent witness sort of stuff, you know, but not quite as gory. Next slide. Here we are. So, a biologist's view. Well, as Glenn said, I'm trained as a vet. So, and I was trained in the veterinary school at the University of Queensland, which wasn't a kind of sort of puppy dog medicine place. It was a place that was designed to service the agricultural industries of the great state of Queensland. You know, Queensland didn't have a university until 1912, wasn't it? 1919. And the reason, and of course, this university is founded in 1853. And the reason Queensland didn't have a university through all those years, Tasmania had one at about the same time, as not much after Victoria, in fact. The reason Queensland didn't have one is because the people who controlled the state did not want the young men to become white-gloved aesthetes who would not work the agricultural industries. I'm told things have changed in Queensland. I'm never quite convinced. But anyway, we were trained in the veterinary school because they realised the example of the agricultural and mechanical universities in the United States, they could actually have people trained in a university to do some practical things. And the vet school trained us in the breed'em, feed'em, eat'em school of veterinary medicine, which is not really regarded sympathetically by the breathless young people who do vet science now, but that's what we did. And so I'm sort of constrained into thinking about things like carrying capacity of a system and genetics and statistics and all those sorts of things. And we talk in the climate change thing, they talk a lot about forcings. I've been trying to learn some of this terminology and language, of course, as I've tried to understand what's going on with this. And the primary forcing of climate change and environmental effects, degradation, all the rest of it, is really human numbers. Now, of course, there's not a great deal we can do about that. We have to deal with the reality of it. But I think you have to consider that these three things all go together, that the population increase, environmental degradation, species loss, and climate change. And we can't really think of them in isolation. But mostly this evening we're going to talk about climate change. I read up on it. I got very interested in this because I was being asked a lot of questions about it. And like all of you, I'm concerned about it. I mean, people don't come out to lectures like this and to occasions like this unless they're concerned about the issue that's being discussed. And so I read into it a lot from about 2005. And it's not easy for a biologist, even someone like me who has been doing some science for quite a long time, to read into an area like this, because it's from the physical sciences, the language is very different, and the various languages of science are very different. We don't all speak in the same way, we use different terminology, and we have different types of approaches, and we do different types of science. And this is very different for me. So I looked into it a lot and read up on it and wrote a kind of a very tentative book, which is the Light History of Hot Air. It's actually as much about political hot air and hot air balloons and spontaneous human combustion as it is about climate change. But that's really the reason I went into it. I didn't realise when we put a balloon on the cover, which is Louise Adler's choice, of course, that I was talking about this in Scotland, and someone gave me this Scottish dictionary, which defined a balloon as a Glasgow term for someone who's full of hot air and whose opinions, though loudly and frequently expressed, are regarded as worthless. I took out the qualification, says, for instance, people involved in making 5-year plans for universities and things like that. I mean, I hope that doesn't. We got one, have we? I missed it. Okay, good. So, anyway, it was a lot of fun doing this, but I don't know if I informed the climate change community very much as a result. So the question is, I think, for those of us who are not professional climate scientists, is where do we get our information on this stuff? I've found some sources that I think are very good. I think, for instance, this book, The Long Thaw, is a very nice book by a geophysicist, very readable, few references on the actual science of climate change. It's written very conservatively, and it actually explains a lot of what the discussion is about and a lot of what the controversies are and where the uncertainties are. Because, of course, in an area that's as complex as this, there will be many, many uncertainties. Nothing is written in stone in this, unless you're a geologist, of course, where everything is written in stone. The National Academies of Sciences are all engaged, and they all have websites that will deal with various aspects of this. Books written for general reading like these. This one is actually a scary book. I haven't been able to finish it yet. It left me too frightened when I read it, and we're all doomed if this one's right. News and Views Perspectives. For those of us who are in the university and can access, say, a university library on the web, I find the general discussions in the science journals, the leading science journals, to be very useful, where you have people summarising the actual science. When you try to read the papers, though, it's almost like trying to read sociology. It's in a different language. It's not English. It's unfamiliar. It's Urdu or something. But anyway. And then government websites. One that's particularly useful, I think, is the NOAA website of the United States. If you want to see the pictures of Arctic melting and all the rest of it, of course, they're very much concerned with the Northern Hemisphere. Skepticism and denial in science. Just some general things about skepticism and denial. Skepticism is absolutely central to science. Good scientists are skeptical. And I think one of the reasons that Australians do relatively well in science for the size of our population is that we're naturally pretty skeptical. We're a nation of knockers, basically. And this is skepticism. You know, this is scientist's hell. The poor guy goes to hell and he's condemned to be in the psychics and astrology section of hell. Of course, if you go along to the bookstore, you'll find that the astrology section is three times as big as the science section, so we get to know where we stand. This is denial. This is the dead parrot sketch from Monty Python. Michael Palin, who is the business person, is in denial that the parrot is dead, and John Cleese is insisting that it is. I mean, you know, he bangs it up and down on the table. It is a dead parrot, but that doesn't necessarily convince our entrepreneur. A proper skepticism. I think we do need to be skeptical, and we need to be skeptical about what we do, but it's very difficult to be a serious skeptic about something you don't really understand very well. It's easy for me to be skeptical in my own field. I've often had the experience where some research is published and we really don't think it's quite right. and we may repeat the experiment, or we may go and look at some different experiment that looks at it in a different way and perhaps find that it is right, or perhaps come to a different conclusion. It's much more difficult to be sceptical about something you're not into. How do you do that? Well, in the end analysis, if you're a scientist, you have to say to yourself that unless you can see obvious flaws that are so obvious that it's egregious, you have to really say that you respect the people that are doing it, you respect that they're obeying the rules of science and that they're operating via proper peer review mechanisms and that their stuff is being published in leading journals. And so you think that what they're saying has probably got some validity to it. You like to see different opinions of it. You like to see different people looking at it from different points of view. And particularly, you like to see the conclusions supported by somewhat different sorts of science. But you can't be absolutely certain, of course. And then, of course, you do. There are people who are in quite, particularly about climate science, we know, who think that the whole thing is totally overblown, that, for instance, Ian Plimer, who writes, I've read his book, he writes very compellingly about the geological changes and what's happened with climate science or climate change through geological time. I found that very useful. I think that's his area of expertise, and I think he does that quite well. He really scared the hell out of me, actually, because there have been massive events that are caused by natural events that would be completely outside our control. We could do nothing about it. I mean, we can't influence the tilt of the Earth's axis, for instance. We can't influence its orbit, how elliptical it is or how circular it is, and all those sorts of things. So actually what Ian Plimer convinced me, and I'm not sure that that's what he really intends with his book, that we should do everything possible to now to do what we're talking about when we're trying to reverse anthropogenic climate change. We should try and stabilise human numbers, because the more human beings are on the planet, if we get a big disaster, the bigger the disaster will be. And we should try and keep all our fossil fuels and uranium and so forth as much as possible as an energy reserve in case something really goes wrong over which we have absolutely no control. For instance, if we got a massive asteroid hit and it blocked out the sun and we couldn't get photosynthesis, where would we get our energy? And the non-renewable energy sources might actually become enormously important. Now, the book itself, I think, has got some problems, and various people have been going into it. This is a strange area, this whole area of climate science, climate denial, and all the rest of it, with a lot of people in considerable controversy. I don't want to go into it to a great extent, but Ian Enting from the University of Melbourne looks into a lot of the mathematical reinterpretations that various people on the denial side of things make, and has written a book about that, and he's actually looking very hard at this book. The book has more than 2,000 references, but what really bothered me about it was that all the data that's given, and there's quite a bit of data, we're not told where any of it comes from, so we'll just leave it at that, I think. Denial. Now, I think any of us who are in science, especially if we're talking publicly about science and trying to interface publicly, are familiar with the fact that denial is a part of what happens when humans confront science that has profound implications. Because science is often threatening in one way or another. It's threatening to all sorts of interests, established financial, business, religious and social interests, for example. And denial could come from the right or the left. It's not a political, and climate science, I think, is not a political issue. It's not a left-right issue, though some people try to paint it that way. Also, if denial serves powerful interests, it brings into the scene all sorts of rather marginal people who are now put into considerable prominence. For instance, we read that 30% of scientists don't believe in climate change. They include everyone who's got a science degree and at some stage of their life and is maybe teaching high school. So it doesn't not that I wish to disparage people who are teaching high school, but it doesn't mean it's talking about the professional scientists, and it's certainly not talking about the professional scientists who are looking into this area. When I've asked the climate scientists which of the professional scientists who are serious scientists who are working in the area are actually highly sceptical about the conclusions from climate science, the people that I've talked to say they come up with about two names, and maybe there's five, but they can't think of the other three. So it's really a kind of small number of people who are seriously looking at the science in a contemporary sense who are unhappy about it. Often, I think, the people who are in that category are not engaging with the current research activity. Did I have more of this stuff? Yeah, crimes against humanity. You've got to think about this. I mean, Holocaust denial. Holocaust denial, of course, is a crime against humanity. It's illegally a crime. It's a crime that people are prosecuted for. HIV/AIDS denial. This is something that has seemed to me to be almost unbelievable. In biomedicine, we've had this terrible HIV/AIDS epidemic. We still have scientists who are denying that the human immunodeficiency virus causes AIDS. It's almost impossible to believe that, but it's true. We have people, for instance, members of National Academies of Science, who are denying that the HIV causes AIDS, despite the fact that the virus has been, it's fulfilled what we call Koch's postulates, the disease has been transmitted with the human immunodeficiency virus, and that if you take a drug that targets the growth of that virus and stops it from replicating, and stops it from growing, people get better, and they look a lot better as long as they're taking the drug. So the case that the HIV causes AIDS is 99.9%. It's 100%, in fact. Yet still, there is denial. Now, why is this important? Why do we care about it? Well, these guys, for instance, for a number of years, had the ear of the president of South Africa, Mbeki. And as a result of that, a lot of the measures that should have been taken to combat AIDS in that country were not taken. And as a consequence of that, they have a much worse epidemic than they might otherwise have had. But still, and to say something about the sort of mindset of people who are in denial, still these guys don't back off, even though enormous numbers of deaths could partially be attributed to them. They still don't back off. Other areas of denial, I mean, for instance, this is really to do with religious authority. Here, people will deny because someone has told them that childhood vaccination is harmful, and you will get denial that vaccines help kids. It's one of the things, if you talk as an immunologist in public forums, you will get this over and over, in fact, that people say that vaccines don't help and that they know how to feed the kid all right to get good immunity. As a consequence of that, I noticed in this morning's paper that we're having an increase in incidence of whooping cough, and that presumably means that kids are not getting whooping cough vaccine, which is really a tragedy and a completely preventable tragedy. And then where will anthropogenic climate change denial lie? Well, it's kind of too early to know that. We don't really know what's going to happen. We've got predictions, but there's still uncertainty in a lot of these issues, and we'd maybe have to wait 200 years, maybe wait till 2300, and then people perhaps will look back and they'll say which of these was the most egregious, which of them was the worst. And, of course, not many of us are going to be around at that stage. Well, that's hopefully not many of us, because if we get everyone to live to 200, the population problem's going to be much, much worse. As I was saying earlier, science in general is being revolutionised by rapid advances in technology. A lot of the advances of science through my lifetime have not been through tremendous intellectual achievement. It really goes forward by changes in the technology and what you get back from applying those new technologies. It's often, I think there's a very nice biblical thing that says, we see through a dark glass darkly in part. I think there was an Ingmar Bergman movie of that name many years ago. And that's often the case, that as the technology improves, what you're seeing in this kind of blur actually starts to come much, much clearer. In biology, we're living through this whole area of where genomics and lipidomics and all these tremendously complex scientific data sets, which we access by having new technology for reading these things out, and as I said, massive computing capacity. And that's really what's happening in the climate science area, that tremendous increase in the availability of data and of information. And as you get more information and more data, then your whole computing becomes much more demanding. And of course, with the climate science thing, we're pulling so many different areas together and trying to integrate this all into some general sort of story. Now, another big difference between what I do in biomedical research and what the climate scientists do is that in biomedical research, we're essentially experimentalists. We decide we're going to see what a virus does or what a drug does, and we do an experiment. We may do the experiment on a mouse or a fruit fly or a zebra fish or a tissue culture dish. We do human experiments. The picture there is not of... she's not taking his tonsils out without an anaesthetic. She's actually swabbing him for influenza virus. That's my colleague Zinkenagel that I share the Nobel Prize with. So if we're going to do experiments, if we're going to do experiments on mice or rats or humans, we have to get ethical approval for those experiments. Everything has to go through a university committee. Those committees are made up of all sorts of people, including people from religious communities, people who are perhaps are actually opposed to animal experimentation, may well sit on our animal experiment committees, because we want to go along with what society thinks is ethical and responsible. And we're required to do that. We're required to do that by government and by law. Now, if you think about it, we're kind of doing an enormous experiment with the whole of humanity. The various graphs I've shown here, where I show graphs that are to do with climate change, they're from the summary report of the International Panel, Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, the IPCC. So these were published in 2007 in the synthesis report, which is put together by the IPCC for policymakers. So this is stuff that has been validated by a large group of scientists. It's from the published peer-reviewed literature, because that's where they got all this stuff. It's been validated by a large group of scientists. And not only that, if it's in the synthesis report of the International Panel for Climate Change, it's been signed off on it by the representatives of the some 50 governments or plus who are involved in the IPCC process. So what the experiment we're doing really is to see what happens with the whole of the humanity, if you like, that's living in this thin layer of atmosphere, and it is a very thin layer of atmosphere, it's like the outer skin on an onion, and we're ramping up the levels of these gases in that atmosphere. We're ramping up the levels of carbon dioxide, of methane, of nitrous oxide, related to our industrial activity, our travel, and all the rest of it. Now, if you think about that, if you put an experiment like that up to a university ethics committee, and said, we're going to take the whole of humanity and we're just going to stick more gas in and we're going to see what happens. Do you think it'll get through? I don't think so. I don't think we'd get to do that experiment. But, of course, we are doing it, and it is a dangerous experiment, and we need to stop doing it somehow, and it's not easy. The other unacceptable experiment, I think, is to simply just keep increasing the numbers on the planet. If you wanted to do that experiment, you certainly wouldn't get it through. If you took a box and you put a few breeding pairs of rats in and said, let's see what happens with these if they just keep breeding, let's see whether they start to run out of food or whether they start to kill each other or what will actually happen. Well, this experiment is happening, and it's been happening in places like Africa. When the tremendous blow-up occurred in Rwanda, Burundi, we had people killing each other. They were living in the most intensive agricultural society in the world, and we had mass murder as a result. And so, again, this is not an experiment that you would ever sanction, but it's not an experiment we can do much about. What can we do about it, this issue of human population? Well, those of us who do infectious disease research believe, and it is a matter of belief, it's not a matter of evidence. Well, there is some evidence, but there's just as much belief in it, that if we can improve human outcomes, we will help to stabilise human population size. The experiment is really, if we look at the advanced world, we see that on the whole, the societies of the advanced world, people are having less children. In fact, they may actually be declining in numbers. Now, of course, that's deeply distressing for economists who want everything to grow all the time. But in fact, it's possibly good for the planet. Now, so we believe that if we can improve human health outcomes globally, we will actually lead to a more stable human population size. If we can ensure that children will survive, that children in agricultural economies will survive, and that people who have no health insurance or retirement benefits or social securities feel they need the security of children. It's called the farmer's insurance. If we can ensure that those children will survive, perhaps family sizes will be reduced. We can do some things to help that. Under conservative administrations over the last few years, we've seen money withdrawn from global women's health programs. This is because of sensitivities about issues like abortion. We really need to fund those programs properly. Women's health is probably the key issue when it comes to stabilising human population size and improving basic health. Now, you might think that the AIDS epidemic has eroded considerably that population growth. It has had some effect, but still populations are growing at a pretty significant rate. So we need to turn this around. And of course, we can't do it by any more means of coercion. Even if we tried, it wouldn't work, and of course, that would be totally unacceptable. And nobody wants a world that doesn't have children in it and that's just got lots of old guys. Some of us should maybe, I don't think we should all live to be 110, really. This is a third experiment that's pretty unacceptable. I mean, this is really unacceptable aesthetically, apart from anything else. But, we just can't keep concreting over all the arable land. I mean, we have to think of development in some other sort of way. We can't keep taking all the grains in the world and turning them into alcohol to fuel cars. We've already got severe starvation problems in many places in Africa where we have dramatic climate change, drought, and really, as I think you'll hear discussed over the next few days, as climate change goes forward, the manifestations initially, I think, will be in areas like food supply and water supply, not necessarily in flooding, but that may come. The predictions from the IPCC for water level rise over the next century, somewhat less than a metre. We don't know whether that's too conservative. Of course, metres sea level rise would create an enormous problem for islands like Tuvalu. But for the rest of us, it wouldn't be so bad. But of course, not everything stops at the turn of the century, where you sometimes get the feeling that's the case. Now, climate science is essentially an observational science. It's not an experimental science. I mean, climate scientists don't get off in a lab with a fan and some ice blocks and a thermometer and a few mice and see what happens. That would be totally meaningless. And it's not much point in doing meaningless science. So their whole science is dependent on their observational systems of the natural world. And of course, this is an enormously complex business, because they're looking at what's happening in the oceans, they're talking about what's happening in the atmosphere, they're looking at what's happening with winds, with rain, they're looking at what's happening with ice in the Antarctic and the Arctic, they're looking at what's happening with glaciers, and you're trying to pull all that together into some sort of integrated whole and make some sort of prediction about what's likely to happen. So it's a tremendous enterprise, in fact, and it's quite unlike any enterprise in science that we've ever before attempted. We've had international cooperation in science before. We had it with, for instance, solving the ozone problem and the hole over the Antarctic and all the rest of it, and we did pull a lot of people together to get CFCs out of the system. But climate science is infinitely more complex than that. And what we have to do in the climate sense is infinitely more difficult than anything we did there. And I think nobody here, I'm sure, underestimates the difficulty of dealing with this type of issue. We're going to hear about some of the real science. Tomorrow, if you come along, you've got the opportunity to hear David Caroli, who is a professional in this area. Of course, Ross Garno has been more concerned with the economics of the situation, and you will hear from some of the people who've been looking at hard data. This little picture is from the NOAA website, and it shows the contraction of Arctic sea ice. That's been occurring very, very rapidly, and which, of course, is a matter of considerable concern. We all worry about polar bears. In fact, even the Bush administration, in the end, admitted that the polar bears were threatened, which is a pretty dramatic thing for them to do. The United States, of course, has also changed its daylight saving rules a month at either end, reflecting the warming effect that they're actually seeing. The measurement systems in the climate area, like biology, have improved very dramatically in the recent past. One major improvement something I've heard a bit about, is that they now have satellites that can measure both the depth and the breadth of the ice sheets. And previously, they were just measuring circumference, but now they can actually get a better idea of the actual ice mass. But you can imagine the difficulties of actually making those calculations, just from that aspect. There are networks of floating diver buoys that CSIRO is maintaining in the Indian Ocean, but are being maintained around the oceans of the world, where you can get much better measurements of ocean temperature. And of course, then they can send that data back via satellites. And then, of course, there is the enormous increase in computing power. So what that means is really that over these last few years, we're starting to look at data sets that would have been totally impossible to access in the past. We're starting to get information that we could never have had before. So my point about historic knowledge being important, and it is important, is valid. But I think anyone who's basing their conclusions about the world's climate only on historic knowledge and is not engaging with the currently active research community is probably not really cognizant fully of what's going on. Now, by saying engaging with the community, that doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that's being said, but you have to be taking on board what they're saying, what they're doing, and what it is that seems to be coming out of their data. The experimental component of climate science is, of course, in the computer models. Now, there's a lot of criticism of climate science on the basis that it's just models. Well, there's really no other way that this can be done. Models are only as good as the data that goes into them, and they're only as good as the design of the model. And I think that's pretty much recognized in the field, so far as I can understand. The IPCC working group on the complex modeling lists something like 25 different models. So they're not just running one or two models, they're running a whole lot of different models that will have different assumptions and design built into them. Not only that, they run the model without the various elements that are supposed to be involved in climate change, the various forcings. One of the forcings, of course, is greenhouse gases. Another one could be volcano activity and so forth. Where they don't have that greenhouse gas forcing in, you get a rather flat line in pretty much all the models. And as I understand it, the conclusions from the models are pretty much, in the broad sense, come to pretty much the same story. Some of the models, for instance, predict cooling. We've been hearing a lot about the fact that the world is no longer warming, that it's cooling. That's based on the fact that 1998 was a very, very hot year. It was an El Nino year, and it was extremely hot. So the statement is that the whole of this century, I mean, the whole of the 21st century, which is 9 years, we've been seeing cooling because it's cooler than 1998. Well, things go up and down, and in actual fact, of the years since between 1997 and 2008, we have 11 of the hottest of the 12 hottest years on record, but that's supposed to be cooling, right? So you can see a little bit of the quality of some of this debate and argument. about the International Panel on Climate Change itself. It's a function of the United Nations Environment Programme and of the World Meteorology Organization. And its role is to try to pull together all the published information in the peer-reviewed literature. It doesn't do science, it doesn't generate any science, and as far as I know, it doesn't commission any science. It just pulls together all the published information that you can find, and then to make a synthesis for government. Now, that means, because it's working only from published information that's been peer-reviewed, that it's going to be a little bit behind, because a lot of stuff that people will know about in the field and will be discussing won't yet be published. Nothing comes out immediately it's found. It is, I believe, an extremely legitimate process. It's probably not a perfect process, but how could a process as complex as this be perfect? It errs, I think, on the conservative side. It involves something like 50 countries, and everything that comes out in the synthesis report, at least, is monitored by government representatives from each of those countries. That's not necessarily true for the other elements of the reports, the more specialised parts of it. You can access this on the web. Anyone can read it, and and the synthesis one, at least, is not unduly difficult to read. Also, as you read it, you find and you read the statements of what is known, you will also find that the people writing the report identify where knowledge is incomplete. There's no monolithic statement that says, this is the way it absolutely is. There are statements that say, we know this with such and such certainty, or this degree of certainty, or that degree of certainty. And there's also very clear statements saying, we believe this area, our understanding is incomplete. There's nothing dogmatic about it, and it's not set in stone. In fact, some of the reports have backed off from conclusions in earlier reports. There was a lot of concern earlier, for example, about the stopping of the Gulf Stream, that they felt that the Atlantic conveyor would slow because of the warming of the ocean. Now I think there's less concern about that, and that presumably is based on getting further measurements and better measurements. That's the printed report. And I actually believe that a lot of people who are extremely critical of this report have never actually looked at it, because they paint it as though it's an extreme statement. I think a lot of what happens in this area is that people commit emotionally to one extreme or the other, and then you have a lot of tension between those two, and people overstate their case in both directions. And a lot of the reaction is really against those extremes, rather than what the actual climate people themselves are saying. Now, talking about climate science, well, the only really good thing to talk about with climate science is not where we've been or where we've come from, it's what we're going to do about it and what it's going to do to us. And I think of that under these headings. I think solutions, security, society, and sustainability. And it's very much a societal and a cultural issue. Solutions. There's lots of technological solutions being talked about. Lots of things are being tried. There's a lot of science being done. And a number of governments are putting a lot of money into this area, as are a lot of private enterprises. A very nice little book that's just been published that really deals with possible solutions on the technological front that would be particularly applicable to Australia. It's from the group at the University of New South Wales, written by Ben McNeil, is this book, The Clean Industrial Revolution. Ben's a young guy, and he writes very well, and it's very clearly laid out, and is, I think, an extremely good read. This is one that's published in North America. There are all sorts of things being talked about, improvements in solar cells, solar furnaces, tide and wave generators, geothermal energy, where you tap right deep into the earth and you tap the heat of the earth. Renewable energy, of course, the ultimate would be to get nuclear fusion working, not nuclear fission, but nuclear fusion, where you essentially replicate on Earth the processes that drive the sun. That's I'm told there's progress in that area. I think it's been a promising area for about 40 years, and some of my physicist friends tell me it'll be a promising area for another 40 years, but if we could actually make it work, it would be wonderful because it would be an endless source of renewable energy. There's a very big program in France. Well, we no longer have all those suspicions about the French, do we? So. There are a lot of things we can do in the short term, and we really do need to start doing them. Reducing the carbon load. Coal is the biggest issue. If we could just take all coal burning out, it would actually make a big difference to the equation. Gasoline and so forth with the newer cars, much, much, much cleaner than they were. Carbon capture and storage, that can be applicable in some places, more difficult in others, because your sites for carbon capture would be very remote from when your power stations are. I don't think, for instance, that in Queensland, South Queensland, where there are a lot of power stations, there's anywhere close by that you could actually do it. I mean, you could liquefy the carbon and then transport it. There's discussion on the biological front of bioreactors. People are designing algal-type systems which will take up carbon and you'll turn it into algae. It's kind of complex and difficult, but there are pilot plants in operation in various places. We could do some simple things in Australia, like exhaust emission checks on cars every year, which aren't done here, but then it would put half the cars off the road, and I don't think that it would be very politically popular. We can burn cleaner fuels. Natural gas is a much cleaner fuel. In Delhi, they cleaned the city up dramatically. You've been to these cities and you know how polluted they are, but Delhi is a lot cleaner than it was, and they did that by powering the buses by natural gas and forcing the people who run those little to use newer equipment. There's a lot that can be done in that sort of sense. I also think that for those who are young and passionate about this whole climate science issue, it's good to learn some of the science. That it's good to know what you're actually talking about when you're discussing these issues, rather than just operating from an emotional base. Operate from a base of actually knowing what you're talking about. And I think some sort of education in science is really very important, both for those who are going to be dealing with this directly and also for the population in general. Methane, we burn methane that comes off the sewage works at Werribee, for instance. We have a methane-driven electricity activity there, as I understand it. I don't know if anyone of my generation can remember gas producers on cars. I think it was poultry manure or something that was used, and you had this gas producer on the back, and it smelled pretty bad and didn't drive the car very fast. I don't think that's the solution to global warming, at least not a very acceptable one. I repeat that it isn't really a left-right issue. I think it's not something that can be done through some sort of rigid government socialist type mechanism. We need governments to put in place the proper regulatory frameworks. We need government to tell industry whether they're going to be subject to carbon tax or trading schemes or whatever, and put those mechanisms in place so that industry knows what it's dealing with. You know, socialist economies, if you look at the old Russian and East German economies, they were the most polluting societies on earth. You can't do it that sort of way. You need to unleash the entrepreneurial activity and the activity that leads to new solutions that come out of people's heads and are not centrally controlled. It's a very bad mistake, I think, to pick areas that you're going to back. You want to let the whole thing go and see what will come out of it, which is what works in science anyway. The tension in this isn't between capitalist and socialist models. The tensions, I think, is between the old, powerful, non-innovative companies that have a vested interest. And ask yourself, how much research actually goes on in our, say, large mining and fossil fuel companies. I think you'll find it is very, very little indeed, especially if you compare it with the type of research that goes on in a pharmaceutical company, where they plough back at about 20% of their profits into research, and they have to. We haven't been accustomed to doing that in areas like energy. And the tension is between those sort of companies and new science-based industrial development, new entrepreneurial development. But of course, the big companies have the wealth and the power, and they have the ear of the politicians, and that is an issue. And so it's going to be an interesting struggle over the next couple of years to see how those settings are actually achieved and what's acceptable. Leaving the issue of solutions, security and mitigation is a really big issue. Food security will be discussed tomorrow. Snow Barlow and Janet McCallman and Tim Reeves are talking about it tomorrow. That is a big issue, especially with the increase in desert. Now, we're still not absolutely certain, I guess, what's happening in southern Australia, but it does look as though our desert area is essentially going to increase in scope and magnitude, which is what's been happening in this kind of belt that's across the world that is subject to this to these types of effects. That brings problems for food production. I mean, we've got these very low rainfalls in what has been the major food producing area of the country. Water is a problem and an issue. Not only lack of water, flooding is an issue, and there are health-related issues to do with water as well. If you have too little water, you run the risk of contaminated water for people. On the other hand, if you have flooding, you flood sewage systems and so forth, and you get problems with things like cholera, and your whole public health system drops down. So you've got that type of issue to deal with. Territorial security. If water levels do rise substantially, then the available land masses are going to have to accommodate a lot of people from low-lying areas. I expect that in Australia, we will feel a particular responsibility to people from low-lying countries and low-lying islands in the Pacific region. But as Leah said, the issue there is how do people retain their cultural identities if they have to be displaced into some other society. Then there will be the incursions that are not particularly welcome. I mean, what do we do if large ships start to turn up again, out on our shores that are loaded with refugees? It's very hard to see that we could do anything other than take people in. Then the sustainability. There is a whole set of ethical issues now, I think, that come up about sustainability. In human history, we have never really had to think in the long term about what we leave in the sense of natural resources for those coming after us. It's not something that's been a consideration. Our numbers have not been that great. We've not been constrained to think in that sort of way. But there is a whole set of philosophical, moral, and ethical arguments now that we really have to face. Are we going to consume all the non-renewable energy? Are we going to consume all the metals and not leave anything for future generations? I mean, you can say they will be so much more inventive than us, but can we really guarantee that? And I think we have to think about how we recycle, we sustain, and we develop for the long-term future in a way that doesn't destroy or damage the future for our children, our grandchildren, and their children. We of course, feel an enormous obligation to our own children and grandchildren, and maybe even those that come after that. But what sort of sense do we have of what obligation we have to humanity in the very long-term future? And obviously, we need to think in those terms in the very long term. With respect to other themes that are in this meeting, we heard something about we're going to hear what's happening in Asia. I've been in Beijing very recently. I was very impressed with the quality of what was in the newspapers about the climate change issue. It was very positive, very directed towards these are the types of solutions we're going after. If you travel in China, you see solar collectors everywhere. It's clear that the country is very conscious of the issue and is trying to do something about it. I just heard a lecture, if you saw what I wrote in the Age this morning from an eminent former president of India, where he was talking about their approach to the renewable energy situation, also using going more towards nuclear power, thorium reactors. India has a lot of thorium. What about the literature of climate change? I haven't really found very much. I mean, you could think that Dorothea McKellar's I Love a Sunburnt Country is certainly about climate change, but it's about the cycles of drought and so forth that we're also familiar with. We're going to have the poets talking on Saturday, Chris Wallace Crabb and so forth will be talking. And I don't know whether we're going to hear the great climate change poems that are going to dominate a lot of our thinking over the next few years. One could think of The Grapes of Wrath as a climate change novel. It grows out of the Oklahoma Dust Bowl. I don't know about Cormac McCarthy's novels about whether The Road is about some terrible nuclear war that followed the stresses and strains of climate change. He doesn't tell us. But I guess we will start to see a literature of this once it really starts to happen and we see the consequences. Maybe visual art forms will be more useful. But again, we've got a great tradition of painting that great Australian dryness with Nolan and Drysdale and all the rest of it. Will we see further issues dealing with perhaps rising in water levels and so forth? The final thing I think we need to be clear about is that in all of this, education is enormously important. Education at every level, having people understand the issues and what's happening, having people deal with reality and not live in worlds that are dominated by fantasy, as so much of our economic activity, for instance, would constrain us to do. I mean, things go better with Coke and all that sort of thing. It doesn't necessarily. Universities are tremendously important. I think the reason that universities are so important is because these are the institutions in our society where we bring together all sorts of other intellectual activity. And we need to be interfacing the universities and reaching out from the universities into industry and business and networking in every way possible. Every area of university activity has some relevance to this issue and what's going to happen in the future and what we need to do to combat it. Maybe it's time to start a virtual institute for combating dangerous climate change at the University of Melbourne. I think if anyone wants to give a large amount of money to the Vice-Chancellor, he would be very happy to have it. That's what Vice-Chancellors do. They get large amounts of money if they can. I think also we have a particular part to play for various reasons. I think we actually helped delay meaningful action on climate change by supporting Bush. I think if Australia hadn't supported Bush, maybe we'd have seen a little bit more activity out of that country. And of course, if we don't have the United States involved, as we didn't, it's very problematic to get anyone else involved. That's changed completely with the election of President Obama. There's a real willingness to change and a real determination to develop new industrial activity that is related to developing clean and green energies. That if that had come somewhat earlier, and if we hadn't had that crazy war in Iraq, maybe the US and the world economy would be in a hell of a lot better shape than it is now. Guy Pearce wrote about those earlier days that are now past and what we were doing with respect to climate change, or what we were not doing. It's kind of a rather sad story. But Australia, I think, does have enormous advantages. We're only 21 million people. We're in a vast landmass. We have very substantial natural resources, particularly resources of things like metals and so forth. Oh. I've lost the whole, I've killed it. Have you had enough? I mean, I could stop now. Oh, no, it's come back. All right, okay. Well, yeah, we've only got 21 million people. We've got this enormous landmass. I mean, you know that scene in the movie Gallipoli where the guy's in the middle of the desert and this old guy's there and these two young boys come up and they're going off to join the army and they say, we're going to fight the Germans. And he says, what do you want to do that for? And they say, well, otherwise they might come and take this place over. And he says, well, they can bloody well have it. And, you know, basically a lot of Australia, we could turn into one enormous solar collector and we wouldn't lose a hell of a lot, would we? And we've got tremendous capacity for solar industry in this country, I think, that we really need to exploit. The other alternative is to do what someone was suggesting the Americans are thinking of doing, is painting everything white. You know, with the loss of the Arctic sea ice, we're losing the albedo, which is the reflection of everything back into space. And as we lose the Arctic ice, you get a lot more heat absorbed. Of course, we're actually getting more ice in the Antarctic. The Antarctic is much colder than the Arctic, and it's not as liable to melting. And actually, we're actually getting an increase in ice, which is what the IPCC was predicting, because we're getting more moisture in the air because of the warming, and then as a result of that, we're getting more precipitation. But evidently, the whole climate thing there is enormously complex, but it's very intriguing. We're getting melting around the edges on the West Antarctic ice sheet. So we could paint the whole country white or we could cover it in solar collectors. Either would be entertaining. And I think we've got to think that with change comes opportunity. I've just been in Belfast. Belfast used to be the great shipbuilding city. They don't build ships there anymore. The Harlan and Wolff Company, which was the big shipbuilding company, they've left the enormous gantries. These kind of dominate the town, in fact, in the shipbuilding yard as a kind of an urban sculpture. It's probably a lot cheaper than pulling them down. Of course, the Harlan & Wolff did build the Titanic. They said they gave it to the British in good shape and they screwed it up, which I suppose is true. But evidently, there's a bit of doubt about some of the quality of the riveting on it. And we don't want to be on the Titanic. I don't think that's a very good place to be. And there's a lot of other alternatives. And we don't want to just bury our head in the sand and not act while other people are acting on these issues. At the moment, as you look at this is a right-wing ostrich, but if you went the other side, it would be a left-wing ostrich. So it's not really... and it does take up the conservative position head firmly. I'm sorry, you can see where my politics lie. I'm not supposed to. No, what a surprise, yeah. Yeah, it was so sad to see. And of course, some of us could get back to our daytime jobs. We were focusing a lot on stopping bird flu from reaching Paris, but now what about the pig? I mean, we'd forgotten all about her. And so I'll go back to influenza and not bore you anymore with my ruminations on the issue of climate change. And what you need to do is come to these meetings, hear the real experts, and you'll get enormous illumination and insight, and you'll be able to argue with them, which is always very important. So thank you.
We have an opportunity for 10 minutes or so in questions, and if you'd like to ask Peter something, and being a Nobel winner, of course, as he's explained, he can answer questions on pretty much anything, so I feel unconstrained.
Yeah, where's David Corolli in the audience?
He's
oh, good. Now I know where he is.
Find a friend.
Okay. Yeah. I know who to refer them to. Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. We have a...
There's a microphone just...
Yeah. We have a dual crisis in the world today. One of them, of course, is climate change. But the other one is the fiscal crisis.
Yeah.
And perhaps we need, what do you think about rethinking the global economy with its emphasis on continual economic expansion?
I there should be a Nobel Prize for economics every year for people who can do that. And I don't know, are there economists in the audience? I don't know who's actually working on this. How do we work with an economy that doesn't require... We're going to hear about this tomorrow from Ross Garnaut. He's going to explain everything about economics. But it's true. I mean, we have to rethink a lot of the way we do things. Now, we tend to think... I think this is a human, very human thing. We tend to think that everything has always been the way it is now, OK? But just think back 40 years, 30 years, if you're elderly enough. I'm not allowed to say old. Elderly enough. I mean... We didn't have internet. We you know, we didn't have the opportunity to talk to someone in India when we wanted our refrigerator fixed. I mean, all sorts of things have changed. Our reality has changed. I mean, anyone and everybody. I when I wrote in the Hot Air book, I thought about Louis XIV. I've got a very messy mind. It goes in all directions, and it's not disciplined. And I thought about the Sun King. You know, he's the most powerful man in the world. By the time the guy died, he didn't have any teeth. Can you imagine the dental pain that everyone went through? You know, everyone around Jane Austen was going through dental pain past a certain age. Just think about it. How the world is different. Think what wonderful lives we have in a physical sense. And of course, a lot of that those lives have really been built on the advances from burning fossil fuels. The Industrial Revolution. We wouldn't be where we are if we hadn't tapped into that enormous source of energy through fossil fuels. Now we have to be clever enough and sophisticated enough to keep what we have that's worthwhile from that, and maybe not everything from it, and switch to some form of renewable energy. Now, if you think about it, we need to do it now, but humanity has to do that sometime soon. There's a lot of coal. And people say Australia has 800 years of coal. What does that mean? It has 800 years of coal if only we burn it. It has 800 years of readily available coal. There's just actually been an analysis of coal in the United States saying that a lot of the predictions for cheap coal in the United States that have it going out much further than it will actually be available. So, you know, we're going to run through these things anyway. So we might as well change now. Might as well be us.
On this side of the room, is that a question? Please.
I was alive in the Depression. I never ever thought that I would ever own a motor car, let alone my own house.
Yeah.
I think it epitomises the problem that our economies have actually been produced from growing things that we need to consume, but we waste. And so we now have a problem of shortening horizons. When I was young, the horizon went on forever. The horizon for my grandchildren is probably 25 or 30 years before significant change needs to.
Yeah.
So that what we've really got is a totally different paradigm of where economies sit. They sit in an environment rather than economies being separated from the environment.
Well, not only that, as we've seen with the economic downturn, that our economy, the health of it, even though we are producing enormous amounts of minerals and so forth, our economy is very much tied towards consumption. And it's kind of a crazy thing. I mean, I don't understand economics. It leaves me totally confused because on the one hand, everyone's upset about how much personal debt people had. And on the other hand, they get very upset when they're not accumulating personal debt. So we pour in money so they'll accumulate more personal debt and more and buy more widgets. Salad shooters. Do we sell salad shooters in Australia? That was the very silliest thing. It used to be advertised all the time on American TV. It was a thing where you fed vegetables into a thing and turned a handle and it shot bits out. It was absolutely essential, and billions of these things. We never got to the salad shooter. That's coming. It's coming. My turn.
Thank you. We have time for a final question, so perhaps in the middle here.
How to word this appropriately. With the free trade agreements going on all around the world, is it not in the wording of the agreements that a tax, a mileage tax for products be put on products coming in from overseas to cover environmental degradation because of all the trade that's not necessary? And if so, would it be too hard to start taxing people against these agreements?
I'm not an expert on international law or treaties or economics. I expect if you put a tax on goods coming in from, say, developing countries, I'm not even sure you can call a lot of developing, under-resourced countries, I think if we did that, we would need to feed that tax back to them in some way. to either preserve the forests or help them deal with these issues and so forth. But, you know, it is, we have the reality of a globalized world. And when you think about it, to deal with climate change does require, I mean, it's essential that we have global action. On the one hand, some societies like ours and the US and now China and so forth have to stop pushing as much stuff into the atmosphere as we've been doing. On the other hand, the poorer countries, we have to preserve the tropical rainforests and all that activity, all that foliage that actually is a great sink for carbon. Also, land practices can be tremendously important in putting more carbon into the atmosphere, and that impacts on what people do in developing countries. So somehow or other, and I think this is also a massive challenge, and you know, globalization hasn't necessarily made life any better for people in a lot of poor countries, but dealing with this issue, somehow or other, we've actually got to spread the resources more globally. Now, one wonders, for example, whether rather than giving developing countries handouts in the form of aid, we actually pay them for their product, the product being the rainforests, so that we're not saying you're kind of subject to us and this is our charity, but we are actually buying from you something that is essential for us and that you are the caretakers of or the masters of. And so maybe, you know, we need that, we need enormous cultural change. And a lot of it, you know, if it doesn't work economically, it's going to be enormously difficult. So even though with the present global meltdown, we may not think as well of economists as we might, they are enormously important in this issue. We just need imaginative economists. We don't need imaginative accountants. That's one of the things that's got us here. We need imaginative economists.
I think we've been enormously privileged tonight to be taken on a journey from Tuvalu to Euro Disney via the poles and now back to Melbourne to ask about our own responsibilities.
Isn't that interesting? The Vice Chancellor recognised it as Euro Disney.
That's right. Will you please join me in thanking?